In particular, what we just heard from Dr. Martin, and this is why we are here today, is there exists the very real policy, the very real possibility that public health has been compromised and public health has been harmed by government corruption. These powerful corporations and influential people have created a turbulent environment for everybody in the marketplace, for policymakers, for bureaucrats, for individuals who have been caught in lockdowns. And in so doing, they have potentially violated their responsibility under the Information Quality Act by enriching stakeholders themselves and their political puppets or corporations. This is a big, big deal, and Dr. Martin has plenty more than his little 5 minutes here in this episode, and I suggest you go to his website to see all the details.
Thank you so much for that, Senator. Dr. Martin, what encouragement and advice can you give our viewers?
Well, I think one of the most important things to do is, and obviously the reason why I'm sharing my evening with all of you is for a very simple reason. This is not a unique situation, but being informed is absolutely essential. The idea of participating in any democratic system anywhere on earth requires education, and that requires the capacity to make independent inquiry. One of the things that I find most alarming is the degree to which we are being asked to accept or believe information because it's fed to us by a headline or by a public health official or by someone who's standing behind a lectern. My goal has always been and has been throughout the last now 20 plus years, my goal is to actually help people find the sources of information to make their own informed decision. And so if I had one takeaway from this, it's A, make sure you source information to inform yourself, number one. But number two, and equally important, be very aware of the fact that we've identified 7 additional pathogens for which this exact template has been queued. So this is actually not a lone event. This is actually something for which a model is being built and tested. And it is incumbent on us to understand that that needs to be disrupted before more harm is done.
Thank you so much for that. And fellow panelists, this has been such a helpful explanation for an ulterior motive for what otherwise would appear to be a wild or natural event. And I think that's essentially what people are looking for, is the type of historical information and context that you're providing here, so we can really make informed decisions, without which consent is not possible. And that is a fundamental medical ethical principle that we need to have access to as free individuals. Our next roundtable will be Dr. Ely, Dr. Jack, and Commissioner Starrett. So we are going to start with Dr. Ely. Your team's peer-reviewed research paper is a focal point for this event and for our call to action at the end of the event. How did this paper come into being, and how accurate is the fatality data being reported by our public health authorities and the media?
Well, Sayre, thank you for those questions. First of all, how did this come into being? It came into being because good people asked questions and didn't take a narrative for the answer. And as we kept asking questions, we kept connecting, we kept asking other people to verify what we had found. We made sure attorneys verified it. We made sure scientists verified it. We made sure colleagues verified it, doctors, licensed doctors. We made sure that what we were saying was accurate before we came out with it, because the way something like this comes about is when people come together and care. That's what happens. So what I want to share with everybody is a quick look at some information, some screenshots that I think is going to be very telling. So the first thing I want to do is substantiate what I had said earlier, that as of February 16th, there is a variance of 8,496 fatalities between what the CDC is reporting for the state of New York, and you can see the screen capture right here, and what the New York State Department of Health is reporting 4 total fatalities. Folks, you have to understand, this cannot happen. A variance of 10, 15 fatalities between the CDC and a state, sure, right? Because the way it's supposed to work is the counties report to the state reports to the CDC. But when you have a growing variance over that has been going on since April 30th, that has now reached 8,496, it calls into question your ability to do something very simple, basic math, right? It calls into question, how does this take place? Why is there such a variance? I still don't have an answer to that today, other than to say it's wrong. When we look at the CDC's data, all the data I'm about to share with you comes directly from the CDC's data tracker. Here are the number of cases per age demographic. One of my big things that I've been screaming about, Sayer, is we have to stop looking at this as aggregate data across for everybody. We have to look at this based upon age stratification. We have to look at this in the 0 to 17 age range, where we've had in over a year 298 total fatalities, a fatality rate of 0.013%, which means that the estimated recovery rate for our kids is 99.987%. In the age 18 to 49 range, we apparently have, and I'm going to start saying apparently based upon what Dr. Martin just shared, we apparently have 11 million cases, but only 15,000 fatalities for a fatality rate of 0.141%. Again, this is the CDC's own data. Folks, that makes a recovery rate, an estimated recovery rate of 99.859%, all right? And it's still held even all the way through the 50 to 64 age demographic. Our problem demographics have always been age 65 to 74 and 75 and older. And we knew that, Sayer, all the way back as early as March 9th when the CDC published a statement through CNBC.com. We've known that our most at risk weren't going to be because of a person's skin color or ethnicity, but it was going to be because of age and comorbid conditions. And it's played out in the data, and it's been playing out in the data. I can't wrap my head, Sayer, around the idea. I can't wrap my head around the idea that for everybody under 65 years of age, they have a recovery rate of 99.623%. But for some reason, we can't be bedside next to the people we love when they're hospitalized. My cousin was just hospitalized last night, and his woman couldn't be by his bedside when he was recovering from a seizure. And they asked him medical-related questions, and he had to give answers after coming out of a seizure. It's unconscionable, Sayer, for that to happen, and it just happened last night. Now, what I want to share with everybody watching is this. There was a document, the NVSS COVID-19 Alert Number 2, because I'm going to take some heat on this. I already know I am, right? Speaking out, you're going to take some heat. But this is the document that changed how certificate of death reporting occurred, okay? And this was issued on March 24th, 2020 last year, published by the CDC on behalf of the NVSS. The NVSS is a National Vital Statistics System. What they wanted to do was they wanted to tell their death certifiers what COVID-19, will COVID-19 be the underlying cause? The underlying cause depends on what and where conditions are reported on the death certificate. However, the rules for coding and selection of the underlying cause of death are expected to result in COVID-19 being the underlying cause more often than not. Isn't that a little quinky-dink, right? And here's this other thing. Should COVID-19 be reported on the death certificate only with a confirmed test? The answer for most of us doctors is yeah. But look at their answer here, Sayer. COVID-19 should be reported on the death certificate for all decedents where the disease caused or is assumed to have caused or contributed to death. Really? Assumed? Certifiers should include as much detail as possible based upon their knowledge of the case, medical records, laboratory testing, etc. If the decedent had other chronic conditions such as COPD or asthma that may have also contributed, these conditions can be reported in part two. Sayer, here's the big deal about that. That is not the way that was done for the previous 17 years. Comorbid pre-existing conditions were always tracked in part one, not part two. Big, big change right there. This should have been reported to the Federal Register. This should have been open for public comment. We should have had an opportunity to review this and say, hey, there's some problems with this guidance you're issuing right here, it's not going to work for these reasons. But we weren't afforded that opportunity. They just pushed it through. So I want to show your I want to show your audience right here. I want to show them a COVID-19 death certificate versus a influenza H1N1 death certificate. If everything's the exact same, if the person is the same, the only difference is COVID-19 versus H1N1. You ready for this, Sarah? If we look on the left, we see that a person, 77-year-old male, 10-year history of hypertension and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, and then he passes away due to COVID-19. They're going to list acute respiratory acidosis for 3 days and COVID-19 for 1 week. And then the things that really contributed to his death, that were the causative factors for his demise, they're going to put down here in part B and de-emphasize them. But if that same guy, Sayer, that same 77-year-old male died instead of COVID, he died from influenza H1N1, look at how different his cause of death, his death certificate's going to look. It's going to look like cardiac arrest resulting from acute respiratory acidosis. Hypertension is going to be mentioned in part one. COPD is going to be mentioned in part one. And then H1N1 can be still be in part one. It's what's called in the handbook that the CDC publishes, an initiating factor, okay? But most doctors would actually put it in part two because they understand, well, he's 77. He had multiple comorbidities. H1N1 didn't kill him. It was the pre-existing conditions that played a larger role in his negative outcome. And that's been taken away, Sayer, from our medical professionals, our coroners, our medical examiners, our physicians. It's been taken away from them by this document, this previous document here, and saying it's got to be COVID. And here's really the thing that gets my gills, Sayer. They were financially incentivized to do it. That's the part that's unethical and unacceptable. So what I'm going to take some heat on, and I'm ready to take the heat on it, okay? But what I'm going to take some heat on is this graphic right here that's starting to make the national rounds, okay? I'm glad we're having the conversation. I'm just glad we're finally talking about this, really, Sayer, okay? Because if we had used the guidelines that we had been using without any problems for the previous 17 years, for these death certificate coding, if we had just used those, our assertion is that the total fatality count due to COVID-19 caused by COVID-19 would be roughly about 21,000 Americans instead of the 348,000 that the CDC is publishing in their provisional counts, which is all I go to. I don't go to their other ones because they can't even get basic math right for the state of New York. So I can't trust that. Does that make sense, right? I can't trust that. So what we're saying here is this. How many deaths were caused by COVID? We don't know, and that's a problem. How many deaths did COVID contribute to? We don't know, and that's a problem. How many deaths were due to comorbidities initiated by the SARS-CoV-2 virus? We don't know, and that's a problem. So what we And to throw another monkey wrench in the monkey wrenches, we don't know now after December 13th how many of these fatalities involve the COVID experimental vaccines, which are still in phase 3 clinical trial, according to the NIH, right? We don't know these things. So we have this incredibly muddied waters. We need, Sayer, an independent audit of all death certificates. And my team has put together a formula where we can incorporate the medical history, the CT values from any PCR testing, and we can organize these into three distinct categories. People who died due to COVID, people who died because of COVID involvement, but due to comorbid conditions, and people who are just miscategorized completely and likely because of it financial incentives. And Sayer, just a final thought on this. You know, we have laws for a reason. The Information Quality Act, the Paperwork Reduction Act, the Administrative Procedures Act. We have these things for a reason, because when we don't follow these laws, data gets compromised and people die as a result. People suffer as a result, and it's got to stop. Enough suffering, it's got to stop.
Wow. Thank you so much for that summarization. This was the primary reason why when those new codes came out and they removed the requirement for testing for virus and just suspicion was all that was required to label someone dead from COVID, that I was shocked. And to see you come through with your colleagues to produce this paper and now shed all the factual light and shed light on the legal violations, if you will, that made that happen, it's just so, so appreciated. Commissioner, as an elected official, what do you think about what you just listened to?
Thank you, Sayre. Well, I do appreciate Dr. Ely's work, and it's certainly opened my eyes. I think the most important thing I would take away from this is if we remember to work with the willing, that we're seeing more and more coalitions of people from all different political perspectives coming together to ask some questions because they're saying something just isn't right. It doesn't feel right. And even on that level, we can then start to look for the information. When we get the information presented to us, then we can start to take action. And the biggest thing that people can have to remember is that there has to be that consistent process that Dr. Ely just mentioned. It can't be selective and it can't be pick and choose when you want to follow the process. It needs to be followed and there needs to be accountability and transparency. And that's where your elected officials need to be held accountable for following those processes that are in statute and in law.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. Dr. Jack, I'm sure you have a lot to add from an ethical and scientific perspective. Like, what concerns about this do you have if it's proven true?
Right. So back to the question about how this all came about through networking, I came to understand that Dr. Ely and colleagues had some compelling results that they just couldn't understand. They weren't making any sense out of it. And I invited the paper to the journal Science, Public Health Policy and the Law as editor-in-chief. This is not my first stint as editor-in-chief. I founded the journal Cancer Informatics, and I was associate editor of Applied Bioinformatics. I serve on numerous editorial boards on a number of scientific journals. I served for a long time on the journal Cancer Research, a very feather in my cap. I'm very proud of that service that I conducted. And today I peer-reviewed two papers in journals you'll probably never hear about. I put a lot of time and effort and energy into making sure that the science that goes forward is validated, it's vetted, it's looked at, as Dr. Ely suggested, by experts. I sent the paper out for blinded peer review. To this day, Dr. Ely and colleagues have no idea who reviewed his paper. And in fact, the peer review standards of the journal Science Public Health Policy meet or exceeds those of journals like the New England Journal of Medicine. So it's, although it's not registered, as just was reported today in USA Today with PubMed and these kinds of organizations, that's because we don't yet have the steam. PubMed has a particular pace of publication that we're not up to. And we also only publish by invitation. And there's a good reason for that. Now, if somebody has a problem with Dr. Ely's paper and think there's something wrong with that analysis, you can contact me and submit your own reanalysis and I'll put it out to peer review just like his. That's called rational discourse. But here's my assessment. I understand the thousands of hours that all of us are putting into this. Right. So Dr. Ely's doing research on this. I'm doing my own independent research on this. And when we get to my slides, I think that's in the next round table. Right. Or do I do it now?
Next round table.
Next one. When we're doing this kind of research, right, we have to understand that we're guessing at motivation. So I might differ a little bit with Dr. Martin. Deeply respectfully, I respect all the work that he did on it. I think CDC shipped out the flawed test. And by shipping out the flawed test, they realized that the only way they had a chance of getting hold of this was to create the scenario where the sensitivity of the test was 100%. They have to catch every case every time they test it, right? But they forgot, and I believe they totally forgot, that when the prevalence is low, when you do that, you ramp up the false positive rate. It's done at a cost to sensitivity. There's a seesaw effect. The more that you test at the beginning, because you have small numbers of cases and you're doing contact tracing, that's fine. But my other analysis and peer review and other journals show that when you do this kind of thing and you change to indiscriminate testing and you start testing anybody any day just because you want to test them, when the prevalence is low, you end up with way too many false positives. And so then you start shutting down society. It all goes back to CDC making the mistake of shipping out that flawed test in their rush, right? They came up with a brand new way of dealing with this that has never been seen before. I've been fact-checked. The fact-checking websites have it wrong. Yes, this paper has been fact-checked. Dr. Ely did, and colleagues did, in fact, identify substantial word differences between what was happening before COVID-19 and after in terms of attribution of, not just attribution of death, but diagnosis of disease as well. So remember, Dr. Deborah Birx in April made the announcement that contrary to how other countries are doing it, CDC is going to count died with as died from, no matter what they died from. Literally a blanket determination of death, as if we have one coroner working in the United States, one person determining the cause of death across all states, all counties, all deaths. If you have a positive result on your test and you died from COVID. Now, put on top of that, that the false positive rates might be as high as 11% or 20% or 50%. Then we have a real problem. It's a technical problem. It can be reversed. And we're seeing that the World Health Organization said, yeah, oops, January 21st, the World Health Organization said, yes, we dialed it up too high with CTs this high. We're going to have to dial it back. The Department of Health of the state of Kansas now has said it. We're going to dial it back. We're going to bring these universal CTs. It's still the wrong approach. You're supposed to use a negative control every patient every time, calculate the CT for that patient, and then calculate the negative control CT and take the difference. It's called Delta CT. It blows my mind that we're not seeing Delta CT or Delta CT in the literature. We're seeing a single threshold. It doesn't make any sense clinical whatsoever. So that's what went wrong, in my opinion. They set the dial to 100% sensitivity. They gave us a bunch of false positives. And then they're like, okay, well, you know what? We're doing it in the name of good. We don't want to miss any because the cost of the false negatives are so high, this thing will get away from us. They forgot about the cost of the false positives. They forgot about the suicides, the deaths of despair, the hundreds of thousands of businesses that have been shut down. The teen suicide rate is an unacceptable public health tragedy right now in the United States of America. And unless and until we have a bare all, CDC come clean and say, you know what, you're right. Dr. Lyons-Weiler has it right. We did it out of the best interest of the country and we made a mistake. Now we can start putting the country back together. But are they going to do it? I doubt it. It's the perverse incentives that Dr. Martin talked about that places them in a position where they should not be responsible for our public health anymore. That's why I've created Plan B. Plan B is a decentralization, depoliticization, and de-incentivization of public health in the United States. Look up my name, look up hashtag Plan B, and you'll see that I want a big, serious sea change in the United States.
Amazing, Dr. Jack. I also took a look at your Plan B. I encourage everyone to read this document. I mean, you've provided a solution to this systemic problem that we're identifying today. Thank you so much. Dr. Ely, what encouragement and advice do you give our viewers that are listening?
Well, I think number one is don't believe fact checkers. Fact checkers are just opinions, you know, masquerading as we know everything. The only way to fact check our work is to do an independent audit of every single death certificate and get them properly categorized. And we welcome that. I will drive, fly, swim to DC if you need me to participate in that. Anybody listening at the CDC, I will do it. I'll be there because we want to get this right. If you're going to make good decisions, my dad drilled this into me for my whole life. Son, if you're going to make good decisions, you need to have accurate data. Most people can't add, son, and you need to know how to add. Dad, you're right. You were right about all of this. That's why we're here, right? Because we need that accurate data. So I would say, if you want to fact check me, I'm with you. Let's fact check it by getting an independent audit of every single death certificate with medical history, with accompanying our PCR CTs, and when they got a positive signal for it. Let's get all that data and get it right, because we need to get it right, because this can never happen again.
Thank you so much for that. Absolutely. We're asking for transparency. We're asking that our federal agencies do their job that they're tasked with And that's all. It's very simple. So thank you so much, panelists. We're going to move to round three. And this is going to include Dr. Bregan, Superintendent Thielman, and of course, Commissioner Starrett. And we are going to start with Dr. Bregan. Thank you. Welcome back here. It seems undeniable at this point that millions of people have become trapped in a web of collateral damage during COVID-19. You've been investigating this, and particularly the mental, emotional aspects. What can you share with us about what you've learned and how bad it is in your professional opinion?
Well, I want to, I'm not your ordinary psychiatrist. I've spent a lot of time looking inside the drug companies, looking at the web of organization around the world. And I want to spend a few minutes, I'll divide up my time and talk about the kind of material that's in my coronavirus website, my coronavirus resource center on my website, bregan.com. I've been involved with legal issues around this virus. I did a 120-page paper with hundreds of references to start the Ohio suit, working with wonderful Tom Renz, who's the attorney doing that work. So I get called in like the ordinary psychiatrist, but there's a combination here. I also have a clinical practice. There's something missing from all the analyses today, and I've been interested in it, and I'm way it's exciting because it's what I spent all my time on in terms of the causation here of where does this start. It doesn't start with CDC. It doesn't start with any of that. I first saw, as Dr. Miller so clearly seen, I'm sure, that all the early research, a lot of it, done in collaboration with China. And that's the word we haven't heard enough about today, that we were actually building viruses with China. So they were working in the Wuhan lab, we're working over here in North Carolina, and we're making deadly pathogenic viruses with the Chinese. We're funding them, and you've heard some of the sources of that, starting with Fauci and through various other sources. And so I began to look at, well, why was nobody saying anything about this? We finally went public on this, blew the whistle on it, got the news up toward the Trump people, into the Trump circle, and he canceled within 2 days of our coming out with it. Trump canceled the collaborations between Fauci and China. He did not cancel the gain of function research that we were still doing, but he saw the China linkage immediately. So we began looking at all of the people who are making money off of this. Whether you look at a Gates or a Bloomberg, a Schwab, even the Koch family, if you look at the top 16 billionaires, every one of them but one has deep ties to China, is making a huge amount of money in China, and is going to be participating in this gigantic cover-up we've seen about the origins of the virus. And because they're making so much money from COVID-19, they don't want it to end. They don't want the cheap drugs coming in. They want the vaccine, the vaccine, the vaccine. They don't want even, they're not even that excited about expensive drugs as much as expensive vaccines. And the one thing they don't want is cheap drugs. So who are all those other people? If you look at the top companies that are shutting down virus information, six companies, Twitter, Facebook, Microsoft, YouTube, Google, Apple, they're all connected to China, deeply connected to China. They all are deeply connected to making money off the virus. Even The Lancet is deeply involved with WHO and with China, protecting China. They set up a commission to investigate China before WHO did, and they put the same Echo Health guy on that WHO did. So we've got the journals, we've got the agencies of all kind, and they're deep. It all goes back to this connection between the United States and China. And if you don't look into that, if you don't look how all these guys are getting rich off China, anticipated the coming of the virus, that's been mentioned, but there's like four or five, six different ways they're out there saying we're going to have a virus in the years leading up to it. They're preparing to make a killing on an epidemic. And they're also at the same time, and I can't exactly tell you why, they're all working with China. So they're all protecting China and they're all dumping on the United States of America. And this will be my last sentence or two about this. America is a democratic republic. Schwab, one of the big thinkers in this whole area of what I call the globalist predators, has said in his newest book that a democratic republic is incompatible with globalism, but they find China to be very compatible with globalism. So in the past year, the last year of the 2019, you have a giant conference. Everybody's there. The Clintons are there. I mean, everybody's there. And it's run by Bloomberg, and they hold it in Beijing. You've got to look at China, because otherwise you're spinning your wheels as to this huge collaboration, what I'm calling the global predators, the corporations, the billionaires. They don't have any identification with the United States. They don't care. Their identification is power, wealth, self-aggrandizement. And they see it in China and China's markets and China's power. So I wanted to add that to this conversation because I felt it would be missing. Now, many of you, yes.
Go ahead.
I have a few more minutes left. How much time do I have to talk about the other?
A few minutes is great.
Two or three.
Yes.
Many of you have already spoken as psychiatrists and psychologists about the terrible toll. I mean, the death rate among adolescents from suicide is literally way beyond that from they'd ever get from the COVID virus, the increase in their suicides. But I want to talk to you about an underlying principle again, rather than all these different diagnoses. We have depression, we got this going up, we got divorce going up, you know, we have all this stuff. The thing that's being ignored everywhere is that human beings are social creatures. Public health, oddly enough, does not take it into account. The entire public health establishment is not interested in collateral damage to the social fabric of humanity. And neither are, incidentally, the global predators. There's a lot in common here that's happening in this universe out there. And human beings, we are so social that, in fact, everything we call mental illness is a social phenomenon. It's either labeled socially or it derives from social suffering. It doesn't come from sitting by yourself. It comes from sitting by yourself when you want to be with people. None of the diagnoses matter. So what we've done by employing public health measures is we've completely ignored every form of social damage. We shut down the churches, we shut down the schools, we leave open the bars so that people can be numb. Human beings, we are born, unlike other animals, into an entirely helpless state. We're born like fetuses, literally, quite literally. We can't walk. It's like you drag us out of a pouch of one of those bouncy creatures from Australia. And then for a year, we're brought up, our brain doubles in size, and it doubles in response to our social life. So your brain is social. And we grow up needing social relationships, social stimulation, caring, we need love. I just published a paper that was remarkably well appreciated on what is the deepest common denominator underneath all basic kind of psychiatric, psychological suffering. And I believe it's a belief that we're not worthy of love, which tails very well with the Judeo-Christian tradition that people don't feel worthy of love. They need to feel valuable and worthwhile. And the public health people and Fauci and the absolute disrespect of all the global predators for humanity has robbing humanity of its feeling that it's worthwhile, deserving of love, deserving of meaning, deserving of caring. That's this huge destructive process, and it all goes back again to the public health implementing what the global predators want for us. I wanted to give you that big overview. I hope it's useful.
It is. Thank you so much, Dr. Bregan. It does speak to the spiritual crisis that many of us are facing due again to the inappropriate public health policies based on distorted, if not absolutely false, data. Thank you. Commissioner, it's Superintendent Thielman next. So you've been one of the few people that have taken a stand on behalf of our kids. Okay, so what can you tell parents watching about how you did it and the positive impacts in-person education has on every person, including the teachers? And if you have some stories to share that you would like to around this topic, it would be great. Maybe a delay here. Do you hear me okay, Mark? I don't think we can hear you right now. Okay, let's see, Mark, can you hear us? Okay, there you go. Hi, Mark. Okay, having trouble hearing you. We might have a technical issue. So I think Jarrett will be addressing that, our sound support. So I'll just jump to Commissioner. What response would you have to what has been shared thus far?
You know, it's funny. I always have to start off with a comment about Dr. Bregan. He has no idea how much he's influenced my thinking. I remember something he said 30 years ago, and he said, and this is from a psychiatrist, that mental illness is a spiritual problem. And he was not saying it from any particular religious discipline. He was saying that just what he outlined is that there is a need in all of us to have that connection, the social connection, the spiritual connection. And one of the first things we noticed was done, and I'm speaking about the state of Oregon because every state is different, but pretty much the macro is that our churches were shut down. Our schools were shut down. Our restaurants were shut down. Our gyms were shut down. These are the places where people find connection. You take that away and you isolate them. But our cannabis shops were open, our liquor stores were open, and what was resumed was not restaurant capacity now, but was a video lottery. So the way I look at it is this: we have to approach each one of these, and this is what we did. A number of resolutions, a number of lawsuits. I testified in federal court in Portland against the governor because of the shutdown of the private schools. And I had heard a governor's spokesperson say, the reason we're doing this is because if we open up the private schools, the faith-based schools, we'll see a mass exodus from the public schools. So we use that in a case. The case in Brooklyn that allowed the churches to open basically said any faith institution, including the faith-based schools, had to open. And if we, and based on that, the schools were open, and our public schools are still shut down because the teachers' unions are not interested in teaching. But what we do is we attack it from resolutions, working with the trade organizations like the restaurant associations, and we work on the local level. We passed a resolution in December, which basically said we need accuracy in COVID data, and we also are going to use this and as a court validated process whereby anybody who is shut down or cited by a state agency like Oregon Occupational Safety Health Association will be able to use this in court as cover for being able to say, hey, listen, we've done everything we should do. We're not going to be dinged for the COVID citations. So we have another resolution that I'm asking the board to pass, and that basically asks the governor to uphold her pledge to support the Constitution, lifts orders restricting our local businesses, considers all our independently owned businesses as essential. And we also ask that she directs her state agencies like the Liquor Control Commission and the Oregon OSHA to cease her limiting their citations to those infractions that were in place before COVID. So we're just basically going to encourage our legislators to also get active and start holding the governor accountable for this overreach from the executive branch. So you do what you can and you hit it from multiple perspectives. And that's what we do. And our constituents are grateful, even though we haven't been able to be effective.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, Mary. Mark, are you back online here? Okay.
Yeah, I had to switch to cell. I apologize for having some internet trouble out here in rural America.
No problem. So